Good afternoon. I'm Gene Meyer, president of the Society. And we're delighted to have for our lunch program this year an interview with General Meese, which I know I very much look forward to, and I suspect all of you will be fascinated. I am not going to do a particular introduction of him. He is certainly known to all of you, and it's so totally appropriate to be doing this interview in the Reagan Museum. To do the interview, we are also totally thrilled to have Judge Carlos Bea, who has they've worked together and known each other for years. Judge Bea is, of course, on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and before that was on the District Court bench in California. And so I think he's the ideal person to do this, and I think without further ado, I am going to turn it over to him. Judge Bea.
Thank you, Gene. This is not the first time that I've met this gentleman here on my right. As a matter of fact, the first time I met him was in 1958, when he was part of the Bolt Hall moot court team, and I was on the Stanford moot court team. And we met in the finals of the state bar moot court competition. And just to show you the versatility of my friend Ed Meese, he was representing a labor union at that time, which I always thought had something to do, since we were in Berkeley, with the result, which was that Cal won. We got the consolation prize, which was a set of useless books from the state bar, which they had the grace of never delivering. This is a man who needs no introduction to the hardy perennials that I see around, but to some of those who are new to the Federalist Society, let me say a few words about him. Ed attended Yale University on a scholarship and then went to Bolt Hall, now called, for reasons I don't understand, Cal Berkeley.
Right? Not by me.
When he got out, he started working as a deputy DA in Alameda County and came to the attention of Governor Reagan for his prosecution of civil disturbances on the Cal campus and also for the legislative work that he did with the state DAs. He served as Governor Reagan as legal advisor and chief of staff during both of Governor Reagan's terms. Then when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980 to the presidency, Ed headed the transition team, and in 1981 to 1985 was counselor to the president, the top advisor to President Reagan. Among his tasks was to be a member of the National Security Council. Then Ed became Attorney General of the United States in 1985 and held that post until August 1988. During those years, he garnered most press notice through his speeches on the effects of pornography and his outspoken advocacy of originalism as the only valid method by which to interpret the Constitution. Since leaving government, he has served in a variety of positions at the Heritage Foundation, the Hoover Institution, at Stanford, and at the board of directors of this society, the Federalist Society. I've told him that from past midwinter events, this crowd can usually be broken down into two groups, the hardy perennials and the new personalities, which are here. And I'd like to ask him first, for the benefit of the hardy perennials, to give us some reflections of those Reagan years, Reagan eras, and perhaps maybe tie it into the present day situation in our country. Now, Ed, would you like to comment, for instance, on how Justices Scalia and Kennedy were selected, what role you played in it, and what commended those two men to Reagan?
Sure. Nino Scalia, of course, was an outstanding law professor. He had practiced law in private practice. He was put on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and was an eminently outstanding a judge along with Robert Bork. And when Ronald Reagan became president, he was very much interested in the federal judiciary because he had suffered at the hands of the federal judiciary when he was governor of California. Some of you will remember that he had a I would say his principal accomplishment as governor was welfare reform. And he was able to reduce the cost of welfare, or at least stop the expanded increase which was taking place. But what he really did was he got a lot of people into jobs and got people who were able-bodied, who there was no reason why they shouldn't work, except they were managed to squeeze within the requirements of the welfare program. Many of them actually who were relieved and allowed to get regular jobs thanked him later on, because for the first time in their lives they were in constructive employment and had a future rather than being on the government dole. At the same time, what he did was raise the stipends for people who were genuinely needy, and so that was really quite an accomplishment. But he had to fight the federal judiciary and the taxpayer-paid lawyers in something called the Rural Legal Assistance Program and various other groups like that, which were essentially taxpayer-paid workers for the liberal movement. And so he was determined, just as he had in California, he was known for appointing some of the best judges in California. He had developed a program of getting quite a bit of information from local lawyers, from local judges, about who the best candidates were, and appointing them to the court. And so he was similarly interested in the same thing with the federal courts. And so one of the things that he did, of course, in his first appointment to the Supreme Court, he told the Department of Justice, then under Bill Smith, the Attorney General in his first term, that he was wanted to look at all the eligible people that they could find, but for the first time to try to include women in that group. And that's how Sandra Day O'Connor, who was an intermediate appellate court judge in Phoenix, was the first appointment. And then it came down to the when the next appointment occurred, when Bill Rehnquist retired. When Chief Justice Berger retired and Bill Rehnquist was raised, it was down really to Bob Bork and to Nino Scalia. And it was a very tough decision because they were both had almost similar backgrounds, both having been professors, both having been in private practice, both being on the Court of Appeal. And quite frankly, he came down to the point where he chose Scalia for two reasons. One was health and age. Nino was younger, and he was in better health. And at that time, as many of you, some of you who know Bob Bork, he was an inveterate smoker, and that augured poorly as far as future health, unfortunately, was true. But in any event, that's really how Nino Scalia was appointed, and has turned out, I think, to follow what Ronald Reagan was looking for, and that was a judge who believed in the Constitution and believed that the Constitution meant what it said, and then put that into his daily judgments as a member of the Supreme Court. In terms of 1987, there were a couple of candidates, it got down to the point, and I'm trying to, Bob Bork, actually. Bob Bork was the candidate, because when that vacancy occurred, there was not even any need for putting out a search, because Bob Bork was obviously the person to do it. And so that, unfortunately, Bob was appointed or nominated at a time when all, it was kind of like the worst possible storm. The Democrats had just taken over the Senate in 1986. We're now in 1987, early 1987. The left wing had really organized for that appointment, and people who called themselves People for the American Way and various other groups, as far left on the political spectrum as you could possibly get, had colluded with members of the Democratic Party who had just taken over the Senate. They wanted to flex their muscles, so you had all of this come together. And as a result, Bob Bork, probably one of the, if not the most qualified person appointed, nominated for the Supreme Court, was unfortunately defeated in a close vote in the Senate. And so then another excellent candidate was nominated, and unfortunately a big deal was made over the fact that he had smoked marijuana while in at Harvard. And it left a vacancy, and among those who had been suggested was Tony Kennedy, who Ronald Reagan knew from his days as governor. Tony had been an active member of the campaigns, been very helpful, but also was an excellent lawyer, had been on the Ninth Circuit, put on the Ninth Circuit by President Nixon in 1975 at the suggestion of Ronald Reagan at that time. The team that we had in the Department of Justice at the time looked over every one of Tony's decisions on the Ninth Circuit. They were all excellent, and as a result, he was appointed, and so we had a good Californian on the Supreme Court at that time.
Talking about good Californians, the next question has to do with an area that we see every now and then in the Ninth Circuit, which is antitrust law, antitrust enforcement. Mm-hmm. Bill Baxter, who was a couple of years ahead of me at Stanford, became the assistant U.S. attorney for antitrust enforcement and really changed the law of antitrust. Would you talk about that?
Sure. Bill Baxter was a real genius on antitrust law. He believed, as Ronald Reagan did, that the antitrust laws should be there to not to try to run businesses in the country, or to have onerous hurdles and barriers to people in business doing what was best for the economy, but rather that there should be a set of rules. Prior to Bill taking over that branch, a lot of the people who were trying to deal with the mergers and acquisitions and other kinds of things that would stimulate their businesses and the economy, they had to essentially go through all the motions and all the cost of getting the merger, for example, ready, and then present it to the antitrust division, and they tell them whether they were right or wrong. And a lot of the times, the antitrust division people had their own criteria of what they thought it'd be, not necessarily just the law, but the kind of things that they thought people ought to do for their own, based upon their own particular ideas. And it was almost like a hurdle contest to get through that set of barriers in order to get your merger approved. Bill, with the president's agreement, set up a set of criteria that would be known in advance and where people could look at the criteria and know what they were and know that they would be utilized in every case in a similar manner, so you didn't have to have this guessing game of do we do this or do we do that, and when the division then would decide whether you'd made the right guesses. And so that essentially was to the benefit of consumers, it was to the benefit of business people, and it's changed, as you point out, Carlos, it really changed the whole antitrust process, which I believe has been continued pretty much to the present time, but for the benefit of people generally in the country.
Yeah, I think it's changed it to emphasize competition rather than protection of competitors.
Well, that was the idea with the original statutes, and that certainly has been the case and was under him. And that was to promote competition, not for its own sake, but competition from the standpoint of benefiting consumers.
We're here in Southern California, and I'm going to ask you to comment some reminiscences on some of the people you were very close to and worked with. And the first one that comes to mind was a fellow that was a great friend of yours and mine from Oxnard, Bill Clark.
Well, Bill Clark was one of the great people in Ronald Reagan's political life. He had worked in the campaign in 1966, and when Ronald Reagan became governor, he was appointed cabinet secretary, which, as some of you know, the cabinet secretary is essentially the person who advises and assists the governor at that time, I think there were something like 40 or 45 different departments of state government. And Pat Brown, Governor Reagan's predecessor, had a cabinet of, I think it was 8 or 10 agency secretaries, each of whom had 4 or 5 of these different departments. Bill Clark developed a plan to streamline that whole program so that we had 4 agency secretaries, each of whom had about 25% of the departments under their control. And Bill was then the one who was kind of the interface between those four secretaries and the governor. And he was the one who developed the idea of the mini-memo. Ronald Reagan was an outstanding person for making decisions, but he liked to get all the facts in front of him, and he liked to have the information where people could identify what the facts were and not just give him a lot of opinions or a lot of political advice. And so the mini-memo was essentially a one-page memorandum that showed what was the issue, what were the various options, what were the facts of the matter, and then a series of decision, what the decision was the president had to make, sometimes with a recommendation, sometimes not, from the members of the cabinet. And that was a way in which really a large and sprawling federal, or rather state bureaucracy was brought essentially under control, where the governor in the three cabinet meetings a week was able to have a pretty good idea of what was going on. And Bill was the one who was really instrumental in that. And then he became the governor's chief of staff in the first year, at the end of the first year in September of 1967. Bill later then became a judge of the Superior Court in San Luis Obispo County. He became a judge on the Court of Appeal, and then ultimately was on the Supreme Court, did an outstanding job there at a time that there were a lot of very critical decisions being made in California. When Ronald Reagan became president, Bill resigned from the Supreme Court, even though he liked it, but he felt the president felt that he could help in a different way, became Deputy Secretary of State, and then ultimately became the president's National Security Advisor. I would say that other than the president himself, one of the persons most responsible for the end of the Cold War was probably Bill Clark. And he had developed an outstanding staff of people, brought in advisors, and really provided the information for Ronald Reagan to make the decisions that led to winning the Cold War and the implosion of the Soviet Union. So he was from a lawyer in Oxnard to the job that he ultimately held. He was a true patriot, a true and very valuable advisor to Ronald Reagan, and a man who just passed away here fairly recently, really did a great service to our country.
I have to think back for an anecdote you may not have heard. In 1981, I saw Bill when he was Deputy Undersecretary of State, and he was frankly depressed about the state of our defense establishment at that time. And if you remember, this was the time of sort of the apogee of Soviet power in Afghanistan and in the Caribbean, and before it started receding. And so I said to him, well, do we have anything like a secret weapon? And he said, yes. So I thought I was going to get a really inside story, right? And he reached into his pocket. Bill was a very devout Catholic. And he pulled out a rosary. How about telling us a little bit about George Shultz?
Well, George Shultz was, of course, at the time. George had, I think, probably held more cabinet positions than anybody in history. I'm not sure. But he had been Secretary of Labor. He had been Director of the Office of Management and Budget. He became Secretary of the Treasury. And that was all prior to Ronald Reagan becoming president. And he was working for Bechtel up in San Francisco at the time. He was one of their top executives there. And so when Al Haig resigned in June of 1982, I guess it was, and Al had gotten a raw deal, by the way. Many of you may remember when Ronald Reagan was shot, he had been on television, and there had been some question about who was in charge, because the vice president was on his way back from Texas. The president, of course, was in the hospital. And so Larry Speakes, who just passed away within the last couple of months, had been left in charge of the press corps because Jim Brady had been shot at the same time the president was. And so someone of the reporters asked him a question. He said, who's in charge, Larry? And Larry said, gosh, I don't know. He'd only been assistant press secretary for 2 weeks, I think, at the time. And so Al heard that, and he was afraid the Russians thought it might take advantage of that, or that some other country would think there was a vacancy, that there was a void in our system of government. So he came running up the stairs to the press room and said, as of now, I'm in control. Well, that was perhaps somewhat of a deviation from the Constitution, for one thing, and perhaps a usurpation of power that wasn't really deserved. And so he kind of got a raw deal. From that time, he could do nothing right, yeah. I think, and so ultimately he resigned. And so it was when he resigned, the president was looking for someone with experience in government, with international experience, and George with Bechtel. Bechtel, as you may know, is one of the largest international construction firms. And so he asked George to become the Secretary of State. So that was his now fourth cabinet position. And he did an outstanding job and was Secretary of State right through to the end.
Good.
And now by the way, George is well into his 90s. And he's still going strong at the Hoover Institution. We were colleagues. He's full-time, I'm part-time there. And he's just doing a terrific job.
Now, moving forward a little bit from your participation in government to your participation outside government, you were a member of the 2006 Iraq Study Group, along with several well-known public servants, including then recently retired Justice O'Connor. I wonder if you would comment on what you learned, with your conclusions at the time, and how things have worked out since then.
Well, in 2006, we were close to losing the war in Iraq. It was not going well, let's put it that way. And so they put together, I think there were 10 of us, if I remember correctly. Leon Panetta, for example, another Californian, was one. It was a great group. And it was one of the best experiences I've had. We worked together through most of 2006, I think, from May. I actually was appointed in May of 2006, and that was kind of interesting. Rudy Giuliani had been one of the original 10 people, and he had ideas of running for president, and he decided that being on the Iraq Study Group was not a career-enhancing experience. And so he resigned, and so then they asked me to take his place. But it was an outstanding group. Jim Baker was a member. Lee Hamilton was a member. I think they were the two co-chairmen. And it was five Democrats, five Republicans. And it was just an outstanding experience of people working together. And I think there were several reasons for that. Number one is all of us knew that we were not going to be running for anything in the future. So it was not a matter of egos and ambitions. Secondly, we agreed that we would not try to ascertain who was responsible for what or point fingers, but rather to look ahead and see what our policy should be for the future. What should the United States do, not who did something wrong in the past. And the third thing was that to the extent possible, we would try to get consensus. And so we came up with a report that essentially said, number one, most of the work has to be done, and most of the responsibility has to be done by the Iraqis themselves, and they have to have a major stake in whatever the ultimate result is, and that we have to have them doing much more, and that our role should be primarily to be providing the training and the example, really, for the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police. And as well as for the rest, a great effort ought to be made with the rest of the government to shoulder their responsibilities. That was a principal one. Number two, that the United States should make an additional effort with more troops, that we were short of troops and that we needed 20 or 30,000 more troops whose primary role would be this task of training and supporting the Iraqis, training them in the things that they would be doing, which we hope would be most of the fighting, but also providing the kinds of technological help that they didn't have themselves. And that meant in communications and intelligence and in transportation, helicopters and that sort of thing, and training then people to take over those functions. And that was our report that we gave to President George W. Bush. It was very interesting. George W. Bush had very strong work habits. He started work early every day. So the only time he could fit into his schedule was a 7 o'clock meeting on this particular day, And so we gave our report to the president. He listened very carefully, and at each one of the 10 of us explained to him personally what we thought was the most important thing he should be doing from the basis of our study and what was in the report to accentuate the things that we thought were most important. And then actually what he did was follow our recommendations, and particularly our recommendations for the surge. You remember that was the phrase that was used. It was the surge of additional troops to particularly to take on this training mission and also to bring in a new commander. That was when General Petraeus became the commander in Iraq, and where really that was the time in 2007 and from that point on that things turned. I must say today, a parenthetical comment, is I have great concerns now about what's happening in Iraq because I'm afraid they're not following many of the things that we talked about. But I was happy at the time that about 85% of the things we recommended in our report, which had close to 100 recommendations, were actually picked up by our government and also by the Iraqis at the time.
Now turning to another subject on the domestic scene, one of the subjects which you've written about and which we're concerned with in the Ninth Circuit is the criminalization of by federal law. We certainly have seen a great proliferation of acts become federal crimes, from drugs to sexual child abuse to unauthorized use of computers. What's your view of the place of the federal government in the criminal field?
Well, it's certainly grown far beyond anything the founders had in mind. And of course, at the beginning, there were only three crimes that were federal crimes. One was treason, of course. One was piracy on the high seas, and other violations of the so-called law of nations, which was essentially the same sort of thing. And the third was counterfeiting. And from that, of course, has grown. In 1998, I was chairman of the American Bar Association's Committee on Federalization of Crime. And one of the things we found was at that time, I think there were 4,000 federal crimes. But we also found that because many of the regulations that are promulgated by the different regulatory agencies have a criminal penalty. In other words, the statute itself says that such and such, let's say the Food and Drug Administration, shall prescribe regulations to carry out the intent of this act. And the violation of those regulations shall be punishable by such and such a period of years and such a fine. Well, we asked the Congressional Reference Service how many crimes there were as a result of these crimes derived from regulatory activity, and they couldn't tell us. There are so many federal crimes. It's estimated today that there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 different ways in which you can go to federal prison. And so one of the things that we have been doing at Heritage Foundation, where I for several years headed up their Center for Criminal Law and Justice Studies, was to try to stop the over-criminalization. You know, there used to be a cartoon in a column in one of the leading national magazines where it says, which brought up all these silly laws. And for example, there's one law, believe it or not, that it is a criminal violation to give a false weather report. Now, I suspect that there are an awful lot of guys on television that ought to be worried if they ever started enforcing that law. But that's the kind of thing that has been on the books for years. But there are all of these obscure statutes, but statutes also that provide an awful lot of discretion to federal prosecutors. All they have to do is pick out a victim, if you will, and in some cases, unfortunately, at the present time, I suspect there's some political hanky-panky going on in who's picked out as a victim. And then they're bound to find a federal regulation or a federal statute that has been violated. And as a matter of fact, one of the authors that we work with wrote a book. It's called Three Felonies a Day, because that was his estimate of how many felonies each of us commits during the course of our daily lives. And so you have a combination of two things. One is the federalization of law. A typical example is anytime there's a big headline case, or particularly a series of headline cases, Then Congress has somebody there stands up and says there ought to be a law, and then they pass one, whether or not it's necessary or not. A typical example was some years ago, you remember carjacking was a big deal, and there were headlines about carjacking. And so, lo and behold, Congress passed the Federal Carjacking Act. Now, there's no jurisdiction in the United States that doesn't have adequate enforcement of carjacking, or police departments or district attorneys neglecting to investigate, arrest, and prosecute, because carjacking is, first, for one thing, pretty visible, and number two, nobody likes carjackers except the thieves. And so we have a federal carjacking. So we have federal bank robbery laws. I used to say when I was in the district attorney's office that if the robber was caught at the scene, if the amount stolen was over $100,000, then the FBI took the case and it became a federal case. If, on the other hand, it was less than $100,000 and the perpetrator had escaped and it was almost impossible to identify who he was or even she was, then it became a local case. And so, and so that's really the state of the law today in terms of too much of the criminal law. Too many laws, and also the federal government getting involved many times when it shouldn't.
Back in 2012, you and Todd Gaziano wrote an article about the unconstitutionality of certain recess appointments. And it's fair to say that your views were pretty much poo-pooed by the mainstream press. In view of the D.C. Circuit's decision invalidating the National Labor Relations Board appointments and the recent argument before the Supreme Court, can you share with us your views and perhaps a prediction or two?
Well, we had this strange idea that before there could be a recess appointment, there ought to be a recess. and in this case, believe it or not, under Harry Reid, who was then and still is the majority leader in the Senate, he had declared a recess. He had decided there was not to be a recess, and they were following a pattern that the Democrats had started under George W. Bush. They didn't want him to make any recess appointments. And so, therefore, they had this pattern of coming into office, of not recessing, and having a pro forma hearing or a pro forma meeting of the Senate every 3 days or so, and so that there was no recess. And being a constitutionalist, President Bush respected that, and so he didn't make any appointments. By contrast, of course, President Obama decided that he would appoint during the same period of time that they were meeting every 3 days in a pro forma meeting, but most of the members of the Senate had gone home. But they did come back during that period of time to pass a few bills during that period of time, and so there was no recess. But he declared that there was a recess and made these appointments to the Labor Relations Board and to this Consumer Protection Agency that had recently been enacted. And so that's what the issue is now. The trial court held that, well, by the way, as you know, once a president does something like that, where he's exceeded his bounds, it's very hard to get this before the court. We discussed standing in the, as you all saw in the earlier session. Well, it's pretty hard to get standing unless somebody has been in some way hurt. And so it took, you couldn't have a citizen go before the Supreme Court and said there was no recess, there shouldn't be recess appointments, or go before the trial court for that matter. And so it had to wait until the National Labor Relations Board, with these improperly appointed members, passed regulations and then proceeded in an enforcement action against a particular defendant. And it was only in that case then that they had standing to bring before the trial court. And that's when the trial court ruled that there was no recess and therefore there was no recess appointment and therefore they didn't have a quorum or a majority of the board in order to pass these regulations. And if the board regulations weren't properly passed, then they couldn't be inflicted on this particular plaintiff. And so I hope that the Supreme Court will agree that you have to have a recess before you have a recess appointment, and that will be the critical issue here. But unfortunately, it has been there are a number of actions like that where there appears, at least, to be an excess of authority taken by the White House And that's why there are a number of these actions that are kind of floating all over the country right now in terms of misuse of executive power.
Now, on a more general basis, the Heritage Foundation profile has you summarizing the Reagan legacy with three principal points, and I will read them to you and ask you how you see those legacies faring today. Point one, cut taxes and keep them low. Point two, defeat and end the Soviet Union, which was then the greatest threat to the U.S. And point three, restore American faith in itself after years of malaise.
Well, those aren't points that I made up, but those were the things that Ronald Reagan campaigned on. Some of you at least are old enough to remember in 1979 and 1980. Those were the three things that he campaigned on. Revitalizing the economy, fighting the Soviet Union and protecting the national security, and the third thing that you mentioned, restoring people's confidence in our institutions and in our country as a nation. I would say in terms of the first one, lowering taxes was a part of the program of revitalizing the economy. There were really four parts. One was reducing tax rates across the board. By the way, that was a tax rate reduction for everybody, not just as the media keeps trying to say it was for the rich. Everybody gained. As a matter of fact, people in the middle income people actually gained more than anybody else. Because one of the things we know is that rich people have accountants and lawyers, and so proportionally they don't pay as much taxes as most of us. But the people in the middle income group was the ones that were really being hit by taxes at that time, which had gone up considerably. Ronald Reagan brought those taxes down. Today, our main fight is to keep the current administration from continuing their efforts to try to raise taxes. But it certainly worked. It started the longest period of peacetime economic growth in the history of the country, which persisted for almost a quarter of a century. The second thing, of course, was protecting the national security, but essentially contending against the Soviet Union. Basically, Ronald Reagan's strategy was, number one, engage the Soviets on the moral plane. There were a lot of people, including some in Congress, some in the previous administrations, that thought it was just two different forms of government contending with each other and that they ought to be living side by side, and that was essentially what they called detente. But the problem was that one of the two parties, namely the Soviet Union, was violating detente on a regular basis, and so that wasn't working out very successfully. And so Ronald Reagan, when he, in 1983, talked about the Soviet Union being the root of all evil in the world today. Now, that scared the heck out of the striped pants group at the State Department. They weren't used to presidents talking that way. But we later learned that it was one of the greatest things to provide hope to the conquered nations, the people behind the Iron Curtain, and particularly the people in the gulags and the various places, that there was hope that we had a president in the United States who saw things as they actually were and was going to do something about it. And then, of course, the rest was to resist the continued aggression by the Soviet Union. He let word go through the ambassador, Dobrynin, back to the rulers in the Kremlin that the free world would not countenance any further aggression like they had just pulled off in Afghanistan. And we also, and the third part of it was to support freedom fighters around the world. So that was the support to in Poland other places, Nicaragua, in Africa, and various other places, and particularly in Afghanistan, and providing the assistance, particularly ground-to-air anti-aircraft air defense capabilities, that sort of thing. Well, the result, of course, of that second resolve, and Ronald Reagan had talked about these things all through his campaigning in 79 and 80, so this is nothing new, but the idea of carrying through on campaign promises may have been new to some people. And as a result, of course, you had things were set in motion that within a couple of years after Ronald Reagan left office, you had the end of the Cold War with the West winning and literally the implosion of the Soviet Union. And then the third thing, of course, was to allow people to have the same kind of confidence that we had in World War II and in the aftermath of World War II, and that was that Americans can do almost anything. and that we have confidence in the people of America, that they have the right answers, and that the government will be responsive and do the things that they should do in terms of keeping faith with the American people. And that was what Ronald Reagan preached. That was what he talked to the people regularly. Many of you will remember his talks on television during the time that he was president. One of my favorites, by the way, was the first time that he had this Oval Office chat, and he was explaining to people the tax program. And he had this chart behind him, and on the chart he was going to show how if you follow the combination of taxes and spending, and that at this point he was going to show how the taxes were going to go be reduced, and how the spending, the growth in spending would be reduced along the same lines. And he was practicing in the afternoon, and he had this chart behind him, and he had the magic marker type of thing, and he was practicing this, how he was going to show this graphically. When he left, and they tore off the practice sheet off the easel, and he was left with a blank easel, he forgot to put the caps on the magic markers. So that night, he's giving the speech, and he comes to the point where he says, "So I'd like to show you just how this will work on this graph." And so he takes the magic marker, and of course, it's dried out, and it doesn't work. So he says, before I show you that, there's something else I want to tell you about this. So he does this. Meanwhile, one of the staffers crawls on his stomach below the view of the television cameras and replaces the magic marker. Ronald Reagan, meanwhile, goes right on with the speech, and the guy crawls out, at which point, the president says, "So I hope you understand it that way, but I'll show you just how it will work." and he goes back. But that was kind of a typical Ronald Reagan. Nobody I've ever seen has any greater poise in front of a camera than he certainly showed in that instance. But anyway, these were the three things. Basically, revitalizing the economy through lowering taxes, rebuilding our military capabilities and pursuing on a strategy, the Soviet Union was a winning strategy, and then rebuilding the faith in ourselves.
Now I want to turn to a question and ask you if you have any views as how Ronald Reagan would have met such issues as we're facing today. For instance, we have a budget deficit which is about five times as great as anything that was run up during his times, but we're reducing our military. We're not building it up. How would he have handled this?
Well, I'm tempted to use one of Ronald Reagan's old jokes because he told this joke about Casey Stengel. Some of you may remember Casey Stengel was the manager of the Yankees. Maybe you don't remember the fact that before he was the manager of the Yankees, he was the manager of the Oakland Oaks in the Pacific Coast League. That's when I was watching baseball. And he told the story about Casey Stengel, and the center fielder kept dropping these balls in practice. And he kept dropping one fly ball after another, and Casey Stengel pulls him out, sends somebody else out to center field. My gosh, this guy drops two balls in a row. Finally, he sends a third one out, and this guy drops one. Casey Stengel says, "I'll show you how to do that." And so he runs out to center field. They send some fly balls out, and the first one slips right through his mitt. Casey Stengel says, "You guys have fouled up this position so badly, nobody can play it." Well, I think Ronald Reagan would feel a little bit like that's the country today. But no, seriously, I think he would be appalled. I think we have increased the national debt by, 70% in the course of the last 4.5 years. He felt in the 1980s that he would allow a certain deficit at the time, providing we were then able to work on slowing the growth of federal spending. And what it was happening, by the time he was leaving the presidency, the increased economic activity, because he was facing two things, having to rebuild the military, and secondly, the recession that we had in the early 80s. But by the end of the 80s, we now had revenues were coming in at a rate of double, with the tax reductions. Because actually, reducing taxes actually increases revenue because it increases economic activity, and it's the economic activity that brings in the revenue. So by the time he left office, we had the deficits, taxes, of course, were bringing in the revenue. the deficits were going down steadily and would have been gone, I think, probably within 2 or 3 years, down to a balanced budget after he left office if spending hadn't picked up again afterwards. I think the last budget that he approved had, I think, $157 billion in deficit compared to today, where at the peak it was, I think, well over $1 trillion, and the most recent figures, I think, are something like 700,000 billion. 700 billion, very close to $1 trillion deficit. And the deficits, unfortunately, are designed without any possibility of bringing it into balance for a long, long time to come, if at all.
I want to ask you about immigration reform. Under Ronald Reagan, we had the 1986 amnesty program. How did that work out, and what would Reagan do now with our situation?
Well, as some of you may remember, a commission had been working on immigration for quite a while when Ronald Reagan became president, and they were under the chairmanship of Father Hesburgh, the retired president of Notre Dame, and their recommendation was to increase the security of the border so that there would not be continuing people coming into the country illegally. Secondly, with the, at that time, I think it was estimated 3 million people who were here illegally, kind of in a position of permanency, to allow them to become a path to citizenship, to become legally in the country, provided that they fulfilled certain criteria. Been here a long period of time, were constructive citizens, had would pay a certain amount of taxes, had no criminal records, and so on. And the idea being that you would cut off future immigration, illegal immigration, and take care of the people already here. And that was the plan. Unfortunately, the people, the legalization of those here went through, was in fact implemented. Unfortunately, the security of the budget of the border and adequate budgets for that were not provided by the Congress, and so we had the situation today. I think Ronald Reagan would say today that the expectations that he had for solving the immigration problem were not met for a variety of reasons, and that unfortunately that's how we grew to the point where today we have something like 11 million. I think that it was a good faith attempt to follow what the commission recommended. He felt it was a humane way of handling a situation, and I think today, probably if he had to make the same decision today, he would not do the same thing.
Now, you've told us about how Reagan handled the Soviets. How would he have handled the war on terror in such concrete situations as the situation in Guantanamo?
Well, I think that the one thing is, I think that he probably would have approved the fact that people who are captured as prisoners, and they are not prisoners of war, because prisoners of war have a status which their own being prisoners of war means that they maintain military discipline. They are part of organized units. They have followed the rules of war, and they are very different from what we have today, which are essentially nothing more than terrorists. And terrorists are those people who don't wear uniforms, they're not identified, they commit acts against civilians, which a prisoner of war would not have done without being punished with death if necessary. And so I think he would have made sure that these terrorists, when they're captured, would have been kept in a place where they would be maintained in a secure conditions, but he would not have them brought into the United States. The prisoners of war during World War II that came into the United States maintained their military posture, maintained their obedience to regulations, and so on. Very different than what you have today in the case of terrorists. And I think Ronald Reagan would have kept them in Guantanamo. I've been to Guantanamo. I've seen the conditions there. They would compare favorably with most good prisons in the United States. Nobody is being mistreated. The most mistreatment that there is there is among the people themselves, who for their their zealous following of their own doctrine and so on are engaged in hunger strikes And there, even every effort is made to keep them nourished so that they don't die by their own hand, if you will, in hunger strikes. So I think he would have approved, and he wouldn't have have all this ambivalence of whether we're going to treat these, how we're going to treat these people. They would have been treated humanely. They would have been treated, but they would not have been given the privileges, if you will, of prisoners of war, but would have been placed in places like Guantanamo.
I'm going to ask you one last question, and then we're going to open it up to the public, to the attendants, to ask you a few more questions until time runs out, and you give me the high sign on that. Educational reform, Ed, the role of unions in public education. What are the principles that Reagan espoused that would be helpful today?
Well, one of the things is he would not have had the federal government take over the education the way it's happening at the present time. And he certainly would not have kowtowed to the unions and allowed the labor unions, the teachers' unions, which are really more interested in the unions than they are in teaching. He would not have allowed them to be guiding and almost demanding what the policies of the government of the country through the federal government would be. Ronald Reagan believed that education was the responsibility of states and local school boards, and while he did bring representatives of education, representatives of the people, parents, and others together, and their purpose, as far as he was concerned, was to identify the problem and then give the problem with recommendations to the states to deal with it, and to deal with it primarily locally. And this was his idea of doing it. What we have today, really, is the allowing by the administration of more and more control of education, particularly primary and secondary education, to be controlled by Washington, by the Department of Education there. He was opposed to the Federal Department of Education. He felt it was unconstitutional and that there was no need for it, and actually tried to get rid of the Department of Education. Unfortunately, the unions had swooped in. Department of Education was created in 1978. By the time Ronald Reagan was working to get it abolished in 1982, the educational unions, the teachers' unions, had such a stranglehold on the Congress that members of Congress who had voted against establishing the department 4 years earlier now refused to vote to end it. And that was the control that these national unions have, controlling the policies of education. We've also seen the situation occur in higher education, where what government has done has now allowed colleges actually to increase their costs to the point. There are only two institutions where we've had the massive increase in cost since 1965. One has been in higher education, and the other has been in medicine. And both of those have happened since the federal government got involved in each, where they hadn't been before. So in both higher education and secondary and primary education, we've seen that things have not gotten better with the federal government involved, and Ronald Reagan would be as opposed to it today as he was when he was president.
All right, now we'd like to open up the microphone to questions from the floor. Please state your name and speak right into the microphone so we can hear you.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Don Wagner, General Meese. It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm privileged to serve in the legislature right now. And every year in early February, we bring a resolution honoring Ronald Reagan. Well, the Democrats, it gives them heartburn, which is reason enough to do it. But they also try to steal his legacy. We hear floor speech after floor speech saying Ronald Reagan raised taxes as governor. Ronald Reagan signed an abortion rights bill as governor. Ronald Reagan, a few things along those lines. You were with him in California. What would you say to them, or like us to say to them, about his true legacy as governor of California?
Okay, well, Ronald Reagan did have to raise taxes in his first 6 months because, as you know, the fiscal year ends in California. It goes from the 1st of July through the 30th of June. And a governor cannot have an unbalanced budget. What happened was when he took office, he was already behind the eight ball as far as the budget was concerned, because his predecessor, Pat Brown, the father of the current incumbent, Pat Brown Pat Brown had actually, as Ronald Reagan once said in the campaign, drained and looted the Treasury, because what he did was he changed the accounting methods during his last year in office to pay for some of the extravagant expenditures that had been made. And so what he did was he spent 15 months of income in 12 months. So when Ronald Reagan took office, there was a deficit already. And so the first thing he did was he got one of the large accounting firms to audit the state to make sure that this was absolutely necessary. And secondly, he got the Attorney General, Tom Lynch, who was a Democrat but a very honest guy, to give an opinion of whether he had to raise taxes in order to balance the budget. And so then he did raise taxes, but when he did, he gave a commitment to the people of California that he would, as he said, squeeze, trim, and otherwise reduce the state budget and would do everything possible to reduce expenditures or to reduce the growth of expenditures while the economy was growing so that we would not have so that we would have surpluses that could be returned, and that any surplus he was able to accomplish would be returned to the people. And as a result of this, through cut, squeeze, and trim, he was in fact able to reduce the growth in the budget, bring the budget into balance, and to have a surplus. And he gave back three surpluses returned to the people during the course of his 8 years in office. So that took care of the budget question. And in terms of the current people in the legislature, it seems to me that, again, it's a matter of reducing the cost of government is the only way that you bring it back into balance. They've done everything possible in the way of taxes. I don't think there's anything left to tax in California these days. In terms of the abortion issue, this was brought to him, and it was called the Therapeutic Abortion Act, and it was brought to him as necessary for the health of the mother. And it was brought to him what the bill said was that in order to be permitted to have an abortion, a woman would have to have the recommendation or the prescription, essentially, of three physicians, that this was necessary for her health. And philosophy was that abortion was wrong unless, and he was persuaded, he spent a whole week of doing nothing but interviewing and meeting with clergymen, doctors, professors, ethicists, everybody he could. And the conclusion that their advice was that it was legitimate to have an abortion, that just as the mother's health was a sufficient reason to perform any other operation, that this would be permissible if it was necessary to save the health of the mother. And so, and he believed that the medical profession would be the break, if you will, the safeguard on the process. Well, unfortunately, we know what happened. Getting a second and third order from a doctor was kind of like going to the garage when you have a car that needs to be repaired, and they say, yeah, we'll give you three estimates, and they bring the three out of the drawer, and you have it. Well, that's the medical profession did the same thing. Ronald Reagan felt always that he had been let down, that he had been preyed upon by the medical profession, and as a result of that, he became the most ardent public official against abortion, even being the only president who wrote a book while he was in office in which he gave the case against abortion. So in fact, he was prevailed upon at the time, took it very seriously, and again, it's one of those cases where he felt he had made a mistake in terms of the ultimate decision he made, which he felt had been for the right reason, but turned out wrong.
Thank you. Next.
Anthony Bruno. General, I was curious to get your perspective on the exercise of discretion in the exercise of executive power. There's a line between prosecutorial discretion and the violation of the Take Care Clause, and I was wondering in three specific areas to get your perspective with regard to this and current administration's waiver wholesale of certain immigration policies and the pretty much unilateral enactment of the DREAM Act, the refusal to enforce certain federal drug laws, which is allowing a lot of states now to legalize marijuana, even though it's still federally proscribed, and with regard to Obamacare, the issuance of blanket waivers for either politically connected people or certain segments of the law, which would affect the efficacy of the law. So I wanted to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, I think that there's no question that in areas where Congress has acted to move beyond what Congress, and in many cases in opposition to what Congress has provided or what the law or the Constitution provided, is the misuse of executive power. And I think in all of the instances in which you've cited them, there has been a misuse of executive power. The reason for the separation of powers and was to provide checks and balances so that you would not have usurpation of power by what the founders really worried about, which was an overly strong executive, because they had been suffering for many years as colonists under King George III, and they didn't want to reproduce that in a federal government. And so one of the conditions of having a central government at the time was to make sure that you did have power divided among the three separate and independent branches. And I think in all three of these cases, prosecutorial discretion means that as cases come by and you have reasons valid to a particular case, that you decide not to prosecute. Maybe there are equitable reasons, maybe there are compassionate reasons, there may be all kinds of reasons. But when you have take a whole group of people and say that those people will not have the law enforced against them even though they're breaking it, that is a violation of separation of powers very clearly, because only Congress can make those kind of laws that are blanket changes in the law for a whole group of people. In terms of the other instances that you talked about, the second one was the second. In terms of the drug laws, it's one thing to decide how you're going to use your resources, but it's in other words, it would not surprise me that the federal government would not use a lot of DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, resources on marijuana, for example, and they never have. But then to proclaim that we're not going to enforce laws that are on the books is totally wrong and totally not within the constitutional requirement that the president faithfully execute the laws, in my opinion. And the third one, in terms of granting waivers, changing deadlines that are in the statute, and those kinds of things, it seems to me this is an absolute violation of what the president has a responsibility to do. Now, for one thing, nobody is making a deal out of it, because the law is such a bad law anyway, that any change that benefits the people and postpones its implementation and hardship is something that people are going to welcome. But if you look at it from a constitutional and legal standpoint, and as lawyers, I think we would all have to say that it is the president utilizing power that he really doesn't have in order to try to change statutes that are valid statutes. And what he should do is go to Congress and have an omnibus bill that takes those areas that need to be changed and give it to them and get an agreement with Congress. We're not going to have amendments. We're not going to do other things that's going to screw up your law, even though, frankly, the best way would be to obviously repeal the whole thing. But that he would make an agreement so that he could exercise the things that most people realize are a good thing necessary to do with a bad law, but do it in a legal way which preserves the power of the legislature and doesn't constitute an executive abuse by the president.
Last question.
Thank you. General Meese, my name is Michael Leaf. I'm a senior deputy DA in Ventura County. You mentioned the book that someone had written that said three felonies a day, that there are so many laws on the books that we're violating them constantly. I know that on the state level, the California Penal Code has ballooned over the last 50 years. I've got a 1932 Penal Code on my desk. It's about a quarter of the size of the Penal Code today. What hope do we have as conservatives or people who believe in limited government when it doesn't really matter which party is in power? Ronald Reagan, who put forth the idea that limited government was best, the scariest words, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. And yet it doesn't matter who's in power, Congress passes more laws, puts more laws on the books that either criminalize behavior or act as a drag on the economy and business. It doesn't matter who is in charge, nobody ever repeals the laws. They just continue to add on like barnacles on the ship of state and slow everything down. What hope do we have if neither party seems interested in reducing the drag on the economy and the nation?
Well, I think that the only real way to do it is primarily to let people know what's really going on, because every time Heritage works a lot on this, and I've done a lot of speaking myself and others have also, and people are just amazed when they find out what the situation really is. And I think it's the power of publicity ultimately that will be making a change. I'm happy to say that there now is a caucus in the House of Representatives of several members who have what they call the Overcriminalization Caucus, which are trying to make a change. And they're trying to change the rules in way to make it harder to pass these kinds of laws that are unnecessary. And there are a number of ways to do it. But one of the ways, right off the bat, that could be done by state legislatures and also by the Congress, and that would be to take away and to amend the laws that allow regulatory agencies to pass regulations which have a criminal impact. And if it's going to be a crime, then it ought to be something that Congress goes through the whole process of debating, having committee hearings, talking about the consequences before it actually becomes a statute that could put people in prison. I think we ought to adopt the policy in every state legislature and in Congress that if it's important enough to put somebody in jail or in prison, it's important enough for the legislative body itself to vote on it after a full procedure of looking at it. And that's the only way, I think. Public opinion and changing the rules of the legislative bodies are the two ways that I think we can work on it.
All right. Well, unfortunately, our time has run out, so let's thank Ed Meese for his...
Thank you. Good job. Good job. You did a great job.